get back now to part two, as Steve had mentioned, on emotional control handles. Emotional control handles, for lack of a better term, I've gone ahead and adopted that title for this, because I think it's important in a day and age when there is so much fodder out there that plays on our emotions, that it certainly does merit our attention on how to control our emotions, on how to manage our feelings, as I pointed out last week. Because just as much as Satan the devil, and last week we laid down a couple of prerequisites before we started getting into these handles. As a matter of fact, we haven't even got into the handles yet. I've been still holding them back a little bit because I wanted to lay down some premises as preamble to prepare you for these handles. And that's why I took the time that I did last week to go ahead and spend so much time on one very important premise. This is a premise. This underscores the world you live in and the reality that you live in that you don't necessarily see, but is nevertheless there. And that is, we live in a spirit world. Satan the devil is in very good health. He's well aware of you. Matter of fact, he's probably more concerned about tripping you up and putting obstacles in your way than most. Why? Because you understand some of the answers to the questions that so many people have about life today. You know why certain things are the way they are. And most importantly, you understand, or at least I hope you do, to a major extent in your Christian walk, because it should be the foundation, it should be basically the whole underscore of your faith of why you were born. That's important. Knowing why you were born is a tremendous answer to have between your ears as a human being. Not many people know that. Not many people in the grand scheme of the population of planet Earth of about 7 billion people know what the purpose of humanity, what our destiny really is. Satan, the devil, hates you to have that knowledge. He does not want you to resonate with you or to have that resonating in you at all, because he knows it's very compelling information. It is very motivating information. And if you succeed, you represent his replacement. He don't like that. Nobody likes to be replaced. Not even demons, and not even Satan the devil himself. So it is important, and we laid that down last week. And we illustrated that how that links up with so often the fact that we as human beings feed on each other in negative fashions by virtue of some of these transmissions that come by way of this demonic world. Because vexation is a major methodology by which Satan the devil influences all of us. It doesn't have to be possession. Forget possession. Let's not go over the top here. Possession happens, yes, I'm not going to dismiss it. But most of our problems come from vexations that we open our minds up to through the fact of our uncontrolled emotions. And as I was going to say before I rudely interrupted myself before, as much as Satan wants to control your mind, he wants to control your emotions. So don't underestimate the fact that he's not only after your mind. He's not just after your ideas. He's not just after putting thoughts in your head. He's not just after you thinking about things that are outrageous or off the grid or off the rails, as they would say, or out of the ballpark. He's also after your emotions, your feelings, your moods. And oh, do we have moods, don't we? I mean, every one of us is a bag of hormones. Are we not? And Satan the devil knows it. He knows, and not only that, he's been studying you and watching you and looking at that Achilles heel. He's looking at that Achilles heel wondering, boy, what could trigger that? Let's see here. How's he hormonal today? I mean, if I was that way, you know, if I was that way and I knew how to take somebody down, as a matter of fact, selling, that's what I did for a living, I sold water treatment equipment. Every time I went to General Motors or Toyota or some pharmaceutical firm or some hospital for a dialysis unit to buy my system, what was I doing? I was trying to take down the competition. I was up against them. It was me and them, me against them. I wanted that company to buy my system. I didn't want them to go with the competition. What was it all about? About me taking them down. I wanted that company to know that my system was superior and they should buy my equipment. And I should be their supplier and vendor. And Satan, the devil, not that I was doing that. I don't want you to draw association. But my point is, in parallel, he's after you, brethren, as he's after me. So it's important we get this fixed in our minds and we understand he wants us to be fighting amongst ourselves. He wants us to be judging one another. He wants your ego and your vanity to be putting yourself above others so that you can play on the fact that you're superior, you're better, I'm more righteous. All these things that are in interplay, or that I'm critical of you because you can't do this or you can't do that, not realizing the fact that, yeah, we're all different, but that doesn't make us, as I mentioned before in part one, better than each other. It just makes us different. That's all. You might be better at something than I am. Does that make you better than me? No. It just makes you more qualified to do that. You wouldn't want me making you dinner. You wouldn't want me fixing your car. I just don't fix cars. But I know my brother-in-law, Steve, he fixes cars. If I want my car looked at, and I did oftentimes years ago, when I was learning about cars, he taught me a lot about what little I know about cars. Nothing on Steve, because he knows a lot, but I just couldn't get it all. But the bottom line is that there are others of us that are better in other things than others, but it doesn't make us better than each other. And so we pointed out and we linked up the fact over there in Matthew 7, verse 1, don't judge others, lest you yourself want to be judged. Titus 3, verses 1 through 8. And if you haven't heard part 1, you might want to go back and review part 1. It'll be posted here shortly. But the bottom line is Titus 3, 1 through 8 illustrates some of the tactics that we should take and approach differences with each other on so that we know how to handle certain things. And I challenged us as we were coming to a conclusion last week on the fact that, you know what, we are going to have problems. We're going to have problems in the church. You're going to have problems in your family. You're going to have problems with your kids and your mate. You're going to have problems on the job. You're going to probably change careers on an average, I think it is, at least 2 to 3 times. If you're in sales and marketing, the average is about every 7 years you change jobs. It may even be more now. Back when I was in sales and marketing, it was every 6 to 7 years. Generally, a salesman or a marketing guy could figure he's going to change his job. In my case, I changed my career 4 times through the course of a 33-year career in water treatment. I was a very good average, roughly. The point of it is, we will have choices and decisions to make in our lives that are going to cause us worry, anxiety, frustration. Might even be painful. Could be painful financially, not necessarily physically. It could be painful because it's scary. I'm going out onto thin ice. I'm going into an area that's uncharted waters, as they would say. You know, I'm going to go into business for myself, and all my life I've been used to having that paycheck coming on a regular basis, and now, if I don't perform and I don't generate results, guess what? I don't eat. It's a whole different story, you know. So things happen in life, and of course, we are going to have to address those things. And so we ended up over there in Galatians, and I want to turn your attention to Galatians chapter 6. Because in some of these cases, brethren, we will find ourselves butting up on and coming up against issues with each other in the church, and maybe even outside of the church with family members and so on, cousins and uncles and aunts and brothers and sisters and other siblings that are not in the church, or even the boss on the job or friends or for co-students at college or wherever we may be, even in high school, if you're a teenager and you have a circle of friends, which most teens do, or a network of friends, the point of it is you will find yourself confronting issues that you might have with each other that are at odds, loggerheads, as they would say. And there are differences of opinion, or there are offenses that have occurred, and consequently the question becomes, how do you handle that as a Christian? How do you handle these things as a Christian in this framing of controlling our emotions? Because that's the backdrop we're speaking from. We're speaking from this backdrop of still controlling our emotions. How do we handle the differences amongst us? Because quite frankly, sometimes those differences or offenses can be so offensive that you just want to tear the head off of that individual. You want to come at them like a raging bull and poke them with your horns, figuratively speaking. You know. So how do you stop yourself from that kind of aggression or not being civil, losing it, as they would say, and in fact yet represent Christ in and amongst that set of circumstances? Well, we brought our attention over here to Galatians chapter 6, and part of the metrics, part of the handle idea, not yet any of the handles I'm talking about yet, but this certainly is a mental handle generated here, listed for us from the Apostle Paul, on how to handle people that have sins amongst us, or who have maybe sinned against us, or maybe wiped sin out of the way, just offended us, said something to us that was insulting. Maybe we deserved it, but we certainly sometimes maybe can't handle the reflection by the way people say it, because let's face it, we all could probably use some improvement in diplomacy, right? or tact, as they would call it. You know, many of us have a tendency to, well, just blurt it out. You know, you got to like me or love me, you know, or like me or hate me, love me or hate me. You know, I just say what I say. Well, hey, that's okay, but consider who you're saying it to. They may not know you as well as you might be with someone else, and you could maybe get away with saying what you're going to say in the way that you're going to say it with that person, but with this one, you can't. Oh, but that's just me. Well, no. We're talking about management control. One of the most fundamental, basic management tenets in management, is that I do not manage A as I would manage B. C is different than B, and D is even different than C. So I can't be like I am with C and handle C like I handle D, because D is different. Why is he different? Well, maybe D's a female. Maybe C is real short and I'm real tall. All these things, brethren, you've got to understand how you come across. What is the air, the aura you carry? When we train ministers, we get into nitty-gritty stuff. We call it servant eldership. But you know what we're talking about? You know what you're going to be introduced to here? And we didn't get into it last week, but that's what we're talking about here in Galatians 6. We're talking about servant leadership. All of you are being trained to be kings and priests in the world tomorrow. We've heard that over and over and over. And if we've been around for any length of time, we've heard it for decade upon decade upon decade. Leaders of the world tomorrow, you know, you're going to be kings and priests ruling the earth under the auspice of Christ, and you will. But you're not going to be ruling the world under Jesus Christ by dictating to everybody. Now, there may be times when you have to be affirmative, and there may be times when you must be rather direct, because some things are just wrong. But in dealing, in most cases, in trying to win the hearts and minds of those we'll be leading, and you're going to be leading Muslims, you're going to be leading Hindus, you're going to be leading Buddhists, you're going to be leading atheists, you're going to be leading Catholics and other types of Presbyterians and Baptists and people who think they know more than you, even though you're a spirit being. I mean, this is real stuff. This is real stuff. So what Paul is saying here is, let me introduce to you servant leadership. Here's what we do when confronted with an issue. Chapter 6, book of Galatians, verse 1. Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault... Man, you are so undiplomatic, Bill. You got to stop being so direct with people. Now, you know, we were supposed to be here at 2 o'clock. It's 2:30. Why can't you ever be on time? I mean, these are things that we're talking about here, brother. You know what? You got to stop drinking. You drink too much. Man, you watch so much television. You know. On and on and on and on. It goes, if you see a man overtaken in a fault, you which are spiritual.
Yeah.
No. No. You which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Why is that? Remember the other premise we established last week? You are no better than anybody else. We're all bought with the same price. You have, as long as you're flesh and blood, nowhere to brag. There's no bragging rights being human beings. No bragging rights. Whether we're the president of a company, an executive of a world global outfit, a pastor in a congregation, a boss on the job, whatever. You have no bragging rights to think that you're better than your employees, that you think you're better than your lay members, that you think you're better than... Because guess what? Everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time, unless you're a real good shot. But my point is, we're all equal in that respect. Christ died for all of us in the same way. So we are all covered in His blood. Therefore, we have to keep that in perspective. And as we approach a brother or a sister in a situation that might be somewhat sensitive, that might be somewhat hard to say, hard to talk about. I mean, I'm sure every one of us, at least most of us in this room, if we have any age on us, have been in a situation where, oh man, I just hate to make this phone call. Or I just hate to confront this issue. I don't want to talk to this person about this, that, or the other thing. Because I know it's going to be difficult. Oh, I know it's going to be hard. I know they're going to have an issue with it. I know they're not going to take it easy. I know it's going to be messy. I'm sure many of us have had that opportunity in our lives where we've had to address certain issues like that. Yet Paul says, when in fact that happens, keep this in mind. Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, you which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit, in the mood, in the attitude, because remember, moods translate to attitudes translate to behavior. I could get up here and do all kinds of role plays, not say a word, and you could see what kind of attitude I've got and probably assign certain words to my role playing up here without me saying a word. But I'm not going to do that. But you know what I'm saying. Attitudes generate behavior. And attitudes come from moods. And moods come from feelings. And feelings can come from demons. Not that I'm going to get spooky with you, but they can. They can. That's what vexation is about. And if you underestimate his tactics, Satan's tactics, you put yourself in a very vulnerable situation. That's why you're going to see some scriptures here on other metrics to help us combat some of this moodiness, some of this attitudinal changing and transitioning that causes behaviors to to surface that maybe we just don't like and are really uncomfortable with in the long run. But he goes on in verse 2, bear you one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. What is that? What do you mean the law of Christ? The law of Christ, because Christ died for you. He bore our sins. He bore our burdens, brethren. And so what Jesus is saying is like I did for you. Look, we're learning to be servant elders. Right now, servant leaders. What does that mean? That means to be service-oriented. That means to be doing things that, guess what, might inconvenience you from time to time, but nevertheless, hopefully serve the purpose of what God wants you to do for the individual or individuals that you're serving in whatever capacity, issue, task that you may be addressing. Point is, selflessness. We heard that term a long time ago, a lot of it, but it's true. It's a word that cannot be diminished, mitigated, or marginalized. It's an important word, learning to be selfless. How can I help? What can I do? In other words, I'm mad at this person. So rather than wanting to tear their head off, I say to myself, how can I help this person? Because I'm here to share with you something. We go through this in the ministry. It's one thing. It's one thing to be a leader. That in itself does not define what you're being developed for. Being a leader is one thing. Being a servant leader is a totally different thing. Why? Because servant leadership requires throttling your emotions. You've got to learn to do this, compartmentalize. That's an important tactic and personality management tool. All of us should learn and learn it quickly. If you don't know what I'm talking about, get a book on compartmentalization. Compartmentalization. Learn to psychologically, mentally, and emotionally compartmentalize. The more you can learn on how to compartmentalize, the sooner you will become fairer to others. Because not learning how to compartmentalize will not allow you to forget what happened at work and then bring it home on the job and kick the cat and the wife, maybe. You heard of people that bring their job home with them? They don't know how to compartmentalize. When they walk out the door, symbolically, you're shutting that section, segment, area off. And now you're going home, hopefully, with a smile on your face, to your wife. And she's there with open arms saying, ah, you know. And you got a happy, happy environment. And now you can settle into that compartment. See? You settle into that compartment. You pet the cat. And you, well, you know what? The wife. But you know what I'm saying. And you have an enjoyable life. Then you go back to work, and when you open up the door, you're on your game. Put on that game face. And go. And go for it. Compartmentalizing. Because look, bear one another's burdens. Learn to put yourself empathy. Put yourself in empathy. The other individual's shoes. Don't look at it from, well, how in the world can you be that way? Why, I'm not that way. Why, long ago, let me tell you. You don't know what that person's wrestling with. So don't be condescending. Be service-oriented. How can you help this person find their way out of that emotional, mental entanglement, whatever it is, whatever it is? And Paul continues on in this section. I'm going to, for the sake of time here, drop down to verse 7. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. I've often said we are the definition of the choices we make. What we sow is the crop. That's the crop we're going to reap in the years to come. And remember, for every cause, there's an effect. Well, I also added, there's always this too. It's parallel. It's in addition. It's also seriously should be considered by all of us. For every action, there's a reaction. And that's true. Change your actions, and you'd be surprised how things can change around you. Because so often we marginalize our own behavior, scratching our heads, wondering why things don't change. When in fact, like Einstein said, how can you expect change when you keep repeating the same thing over and over? That's insanity. That's a definition of insanity. To think you can repeat the same behaviors, the same reactions, or the same actions, I'm sorry, the same actions, and expect different reactions, or expect different results. You can't. That's insanity. You're going to get the same reactions or the same results. Change the actions. Change the cycle. Rearrange the pattern so the cycle changes up. And most likely, you will see that what you reap is different. And it will come home to you in time as you begin to develop this habit of acting in different ways. Verse 8, he goes on, "For he that sows to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption, but he that sows to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. And let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we don't quit." That's what that means. You quit, game over. You disqualified yourself, took yourself out, you put yourself on the bench. Don't faint. And he goes on here in verse 10, "As we have therefore," or he kind of exhales and says, "therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good unto all men." Get that? Everybody. All men. Do good unto all men. How can I help this guy at work? I mean, this guy is really a bad guy. But I got to help him. How am I going to help this guy? This boss doesn't have a clue on what's going on in the field. He's not even from my industry. And he thinks he knows more than me. And I've been in this industry for 15 years. What am I going to do with this guy? How can I help him? But yet that's what we should be doing, brother. That's how we should be thinking. Problem comes up. Individual offends. Does something off the rails. We catch it. What do? Tear his head off? Tackle him? Take him out? Hope he doesn't ever come back to me or come back to us or whatever it may be? No. How can we help him? Notice, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. Wow. That means each and every one of us in this room has a special obligation to each and every one of us in this room, a special obligation that we exercise the patience with each other. More of a mandate to one another. We owe that to each other. Why? Because we're all called. We're all mature enough to recognize that we've been called by God the Father and Jesus Christ. We all know why we've been born. We understand all what our destiny is. We're all one happy family. Right? And we should be. Because we should be all on the same page in the big picture. Where it gets a little complex is the differences of personalities and the compatibilities that come along with that as we attempt to try to integrate and assimilate into a congregation. Not that we've got problems here in Medina, and I certainly don't want rumors to go out on the internet that we've got problems in Medina. But the fact of it is, that's what life is all about. We've got to be cognizant of these things so that we don't let these things get away from us, and especially to those of us in the church. So it is so important for all of us to basically learn how to handle some of these things in and amongst ourselves. Because notice over here in Matthew 18. Notice this in Matthew 18. A description that Jesus Christ laid down for us, a metric in how to handle issues among ourselves. And this is important, brethren, because sometimes, you know, people say, well, he owes me getting back to me. But the fact of it is, in some cases, he or she who's been offended doesn't even know, or let me say it this way, the one who is trying to get back, I lost my train of thought, the offended party sometimes doesn't even know they created an offense, is what I'm trying to say. And so we who are offended are expecting them to come to us when in fact they don't even realize, that is, the person who offended us, they're even aware they offended us. Therefore, it's incumbent on us who are offended, if indeed that occurs, to come, verse 15, moreover, if your brother shall trespass against you, that means I've got a problem with what he just did or she just did to me, go and tell them his fault between you and him alone. How are you going to do that? Galatians 6. How are you going to do that? Galatians 6. And also, let me just stop right there in Matthew 18 and support Galatians 6 with another section of Scripture. Let me take you over to 2 Timothy, and in chapter 2, 2 Timothy and in chapter 2, verse 23, this substantiates Galatians 6. But foolish and unlearned questions avoid, knowing that they do gender strife, and the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle. Link this up with Galatians 6. Be gentle unto all men, unto all, not just the church. Again, I want to emphasize this. This extends outside of the church. In verse 24, apt to teach and teach patient. And that's important, meaning forbearing. In other words, you're apt to teach in a forbearing fashion to work this individual through why you were offended. That's important. That you patiently manage your emotions, even though you want to tear this guy's head off, as I said, and you're throttling everything you can do because this guy's really hurt you, this woman has really hurt you. You, in all due respect, are asking yourself, premising this, laying down this foundation, this underscore that, hey, guess what? I'm going to help this individual. And how am I going to help him? Galatians 6 and 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24 now. And the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle unto all men, apt to teach, patient, in meekness. Look at this now. Instructing those that oppose themselves. Oh, I didn't even know that I did that. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that. I'm sorry. Believe me, I didn't mean it. Well, you did it. Oh, no. Once that happens, the onus is on you. Oh, I'm sorry. What are you going to do with that? What are you going to do with that? Well, say it again. I want you to say it right at 100 times. But that's where it's at, brethren. What are you going to do with that? Because look at this. It gets better here in Timothy. 2 Timothy, verse 25, chapter 2. In meekness, instructing those that oppose themselves, if God perhaps, that's what peradventure means, perhaps will give them repentance to the acknowledging of the truth. Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. I got it 20-20. You know, but in all due respect, I really didn't mean it that way. Here's how. I don't want to hear that. Yeah, I don't hear that. But wait, I just want to. I don't want to hear that. See how things can get out of focus real fast. and the civility, we lose it, and we can't communicate. It happens in marriages. It happens with siblings. It happens in families. The "I'm sorry" is never heard or never said. That's another way that it can go. There's a lot of rabbit holes that a lot of our interaction can occur in terms of the options that are available, that oftentimes, again, generate the reaction or the result of the action. So he goes on, 26, chapter 2, 2 Timothy, "and that they may recover themselves," look at this, back to that original premise we talked about. What's it all about, brethren? What's it all about? "That they may recover themselves out of the snare of the devil, who are taken captive by him," the devil, "at his will." Because some of us are weak. And some of us repeat, and that's what's even more maddening, some of us repeat the same sins, mistakes, bad choices, over and over and over again. And then what happens? We've got to do something that Jesus said. But before we get to that, let me go back to Matthew 18 and finish this up. "Moreover, if your brother shall trespass against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he shall hear you," meaning, as we just showed in 2 Timothy chapter 2, that he repents, that he says he's sorry, he acknowledges what he or she has done, they take and hold themselves responsible and accountable, then guess what? Here is the objective, the metric objective we should have as Christians, not only amongst ourselves, but also to the world at large, outside, who we interact with as well in the unconverted arena where our lives take place. It says here, look at this, that if he shall hear you, you have gained your brother. That's important, brethren. That is a successful recovery mission. We're at odds. We're in loggerheads. We've got a chasm between us. How do we bridge it? And if we do, and we can shake hands and put our arms around one another again, yeah. That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. That's a mission accomplished. You've gained a brother. And in all due respect, that is the objective that we are indeed after. But in all due respect, as pointed out, sometimes our emotions, which again, let me repeat, are indeed the windows to our attitudes, alter and make certain behavioral transitions occur that prevent us from completing the construction of those bridges that hopefully will generate what's listed there. And I'm not going to turn there. I'm just going to list it in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 1 through about 3. Ephesians 4, 1 through about 3, because that's where we need to be. That is really where we need to be, Ephesians 4 and 1 through 3. So uncontrolled emotions can lead to a lot of bad behaviors, of which, unfortunately, create environments and conditions that make a bad situation worse, whether they are emotional outbursts, whether it's anger, whether it is a tantrum. Did you ever see a little kid throw a tantrum? I've seen that many times. I've even seen out in public where in the store, the kid will just stamp their legs, they'll go into this uncontrollable screaming and crying. In Canada, you can't even spank your children in public. If you did, you could go to jail for all intents and purposes and have a lawsuit against you if someone chooses to go ahead and bring that to the attention of the authorities. But these kinds of things cause oftentimes emotions or relationships to be broken, sometimes physical things to be broken. As I portrayed last week, you threw the vase that was worth $2,000 you got from, as a family heirloom. And the next day, you say, "Oh, what did I do?" But in the fit of anger, you weren't thinking. You weren't controlled. And that old emotional mood that came from feelings drove you into a behavior that did something that now you regret, you see. So it's important we get a handle on this. And not only that, but uncontrolled emotions can generate sickness. It's not good. It can generate high blood pressure. It can provide ulcers and hives and skin disorders. It can cause you to have welts and shingles, heart attacks, strokes, sleeping and eating and stomach disorders, all kinds of stuff. People who fret, worry, have a lot of anxiety, are anxious over this, that, or the other thing, they bite their lips, they chew on their tongues, they have all kinds of issues that oftentimes, I've worked with guys like that. What are we going to do, Bill? What are we going to do about that project? What are we going to do about that project? Down, boy, down, easy, relax. You know, and he's a nervous wreck. But these things happen. Over here in Proverbs, look at this, in Proverbs chapter 16. Notice what the best psychology book has to say about emotions, especially when they manifest in anger. Chapter 16, verse 32. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that rules his spirit than he that takes a city. A person who can control their spirit in a managed, throttled way, whereby he can steer, think, strategize, and be able to hopefully generate an environment that develops that bridge across that chasm of difference, is greater, your Bible says here, than he that takes a city. Chapter 14, just a few pages before, in verse 29, look at this. He that is slow to wrath or anger is of great understanding. Why is that? Because guess what? Your emotions aren't blocking you. That's a beta blocker. That's a major. Once you get emotional and defensive, you are down and out. Everything from that point on, you run the risk of having it to be distorted in your intake box. Because everything now that's being said, everything now that you are assimilating, everything now you're digesting, everything coming to you is perhaps fraught because it's skewed due to your emotions, due to your anger, due to your defensive mechanisms, which now are blocking you and creating this net of deflection that, frankly, what that individual is saying, I don't know if you've ever seen movies, you know, where the guy is, he's listening, but it's just kind of echoing. Spiritually speaking, that's what's happening. You're just surrounded by a lot of echoing and really no meaning. You think you've got meaning, but that's why I always say, never talk to a drunk. Drunks don't understand, nor do angry people understand. Angry people or people who are drunk on anger don't understand. Go to an Antifa rally. The alt-right. That's out of control anger. And that's not a place to be when in fact you are indeed having opportunity to think that through. So to counter this is, and in Proverbs we're told here in chapter 15, to do this. As hard as it may be sometimes, brethren, it's very, what you could say, important to be encouraged to do this in verse 13. A merry heart makes a cheerful countenance, but by sorrow of the heart, the spirit is broken. So try to stay away from the painful things. Try to stay away from the vexing things of life. If you can't handle the fire, get out of the kitchen. If there are certain things that you just cannot deal with and you have the ability to avoid them, avoid them. In my later years now of my life, as much as I was in my younger years aggressive and, you know, competitive and all of those things, the fact remains now I see the value, the great value that I wish I would have seen sooner in my life, of being more patient and allowing things to kind of play out a little bit more and a little bit longer before one takes action into something. And to avoid as much as possible circumstances that might cause disruption or that might cause a skewing of the peace that one likes to enjoy for the majority of one's life. And there's great value in that, a tremendous value. Over here in Proverbs chapter 17, a few pages over, chapter 17, and in verse 22, we read, a merry heart does good. It's like a medicine. A happy heart is like a medicine. But a broken spirit, well, it dries the bones. It afflicts. It afflicts the bones. And it does. A broken spirit, things that happen due to life's situations do indeed draw on us and weigh on us. If we can avoid those things, then we should take opportunity to do the best we can to avoid those things and approach life in a very happy and merry fashion. And this brings me, believe it or not, this brings me to our first handle. Our first handle. So we're not going to get this done today. That'll be a part three. But handle number one. On emotional control. Emotional control handle number one. Have a positive outlook. Wow, am I glad to be alive again. Another day in paradise. You go into the office and guess what? You've got a smile on your face. You're back slapping, or at least, you know, figuratively speaking, you're on your game. Hey, how you doing? Good to see you this morning. How was your weekend? You set the tone, especially if you are a manager, if you are a boss. Your tempo, your attitude, your mood, your emotional state can actually set the whole course of the office on that particular day, or depending on how you are as the week wears on, because it's nice and easy perhaps to come in on Monday when nothing's happened yet. But how are you doing on Thursday and Friday? You see, those are important things too. Are you able to keep up the pace? Are you able to maintain the same status quo? Because that's an important element for your employees and or your family, your friends to see. Because guess what? You're being known by that type of personality profile. You're developing your legacy every day you live, your reputation. The kind of person you are will be described by others predicated on how you act, how you behave in public the majority of the time, because that's what's gaining the attention of what your profile is going to be made up of. So it's important that we do the best we can to maintain positive, because I think, aren't we all in agreement? We'd all like to be characterized as being positive people. I want to be. I want to be characterized as being an optimist, you know, not a naive optimist, but, you know, an optimist. I'd rather have the glass half full than, as they would say, half empty. Over here in Philippians chapter 4, Philippians chapter 4 gives us again some metrics to reference as far as how to maintain this mood, this attitude of happiness and being positive. In chapter 4 and in verse 4, notice this, he says, rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say rejoice. And this word rejoice is an important Greek word because it means to be calmly happy. It doesn't mean to be giddy. It doesn't mean to be naively happy or stupidly happy or just, you know, over the top and hyperbolously happy. But it means to be calmly happy, that there's a happiness in you that provides a certain positive approach and positive perception that people have of you. And that's important, brethren. He's saying here, rejoice in the Lord, be calm, be glad, cheerful, but calm in your wellness, is essentially what the Greek is. In the Lord always, and again I say rejoice, let your moderation be known unto all men. The Lord is at hand. Be careful for nothing. Don't worry. That means don't be anxious for nothing. But in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known of God. Remember Jesus said, you who are heavy laden, come unto me, I'll give you rest. Remember that? We need to believe that, brethren. You got problems? Sometimes they overwhelm us. They are issues that sometimes overwhelm us. Go to Christ. Go in prayer. Have faith. And implore God, beseech God to work those things out for you. Career change, whatever it may be. Problems with your children, problems with your mates, problems on the job, whatever it may be. Go to God. Let God get involved in your life. Appeal to God for His intervention in your life. And the peace, that is the rest and prosperity. This Greek word means rest and prosperity, peace. That means the peace, that's a prosperous thing to have. That's a rich thing to have. It's a good thing to have. It's currency, spiritual currency in your pocket because it's peace with God. And how does that come? Well, look at this. Look at this. What is he telling us? He says, and the peace of God which passes all understanding shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ. How does the peace of God come to me? How do I, Bill Watson, or you, whoever you are, come to understand that I have a prosperous understanding with the Lord that affords me a peace with Him that allows me to illuminate, to reflect, to exemplify a happy spirit, a positive approach toward life? Well, I'll tell you why. We've already talked about it. We've already talked about it. And you know it. You know why you were born. It's that simple. You have the overriding knowledge of knowing what your destiny is. You have the overriding information of the value of life and the fact, the reality of the fact. It's priceless. It's priceless. You can't put a price on the idea that you are destined to become a born son in the family of God as a resurrected spirit being who's going to rule with Jesus Christ from the Mount of Olives and reinstitute the government of God on earth for all humanity to be the beneficiaries of. You, brethren, me, hopefully, are going to be the benefactors of mankind. That's awesome. So we've got to keep these things in perspective, as they would say. The peace of God comes to you when you're in the weeds, as they would say, dealing with something on a human level, not to let it get out of focus, because it is what it is. This too will pass, as they would say. The overriding peace that you have is by far much more exceedingly glorious, that whereby, as Paul said, I reckon that even the worst things in this world shouldn't be compared to what God has in store for us on the other side of this physical life. So we're told here, finally, brethren, look at whatsoever are true, honest, just, and pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are good, report. If there be any virtue, and this virtue is excellence, you know, if there's any excellence, and if there be any praise, think on these things. So if ever you wonder, what should I think about? Or if ever you wonder how to displace all of a sudden this vexation of spirit you find yourself dealing with because of something that happened and has thrown you into this negative feeling that has now transitioned into a mood that is now fast approaching an attitude which you know is ultimately going to surface as an action and a behavior. How do you stop that? Go back to Philippians. Make it a daily, if you need to, course of reading. Philippians 4, verse 8. Keep that in your mind. If you ever want to recognize and replace, do it that way. Because these are good things. These are good metrics to always keep in mind. A few pages over, Colossians chapter 3, real quickly here. Put on, therefore, as the elect of God, holy, beloved, bowels of mercy, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, long-suffering, forbearing one another, forgiving one another. If any man has a quarrel against any, even as Christ forgave you, so also do you. And above all these things, put on charity, agape, which is the bond of completeness. It is the bond of maturity. And let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which Also, you are called in one body, and be you thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, in all wisdom, teaching, admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord, and whatsoever you do, in the word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, giving thanks to God and the Father by Him. That's important, brethren. These are very, very important points to keep in mind as we do the best we can to keep a positive attitude in our approach toward emotional control. So with that, we'll pick up on handle number 2 the next time I'm back here, which will be in a few weeks, and we'll continue on until we get this done.